Attacks on ships in the Red Sea by the Yemeni Houthi militia have upended global trade routes. With nearly 30% of global container shipping passing through the Suez Canal, the attacks have seen major disruption in rerouting. The response has been the deployment of Operation Prosperity Guardian, a more than 20-country military campaign designed to degrade the Houthis' offensive capabilities in an effort to stop the attacks and reopen the shipping route.
Over recent months, the Houthi militia have repeatedly attacked commercial ships in the Red Sea, risking innocent lives and causing huge economic disruption. In December, we launched Operation Prosperity Guardian with our allies.
While these attacks have thrown the precarious nature of global supply chains into the headlines, they're just the latest in a series of major shocks that began during the pandemic and sped up after the invasion of Ukraine and amid growing tensions between the United States and China.
The pandemic had led to the most profound and widespread set of disruptions to our transportation systems since 9/11.
Companies, shippers, etc. will be very concerned about what happens to their ships and to their personnel if Russia's opposing any export of food products from Ukraine.
So what does all this mean for your next iPhone update and for global security? I'm Emma Beals, and this is Not a Drill. Anyone who tried to order a new TV or sofa during the pandemic likely felt the effects of disrupted supply chains and global shipping routes. But rather than returning to normal along with the rest of our daily lives, the vast world of container shipping and supply chains continued to face external shocks born of conflict and geopolitical tensions. Securing supply chains has even become a central tenet of the current US administration's foreign policy. Last November, Yemen's Houthi movement began the first of tens of attacks on commercial ships in the Red Sea as they made their way towards the Suez Canal on the busy trade route from Asia to Europe. Suddenly, supply chains and a Houthi pirate with a TikTok account were all over the news. Shipping routes radically shifted, but in truth, supply chains have been quietly changing over the past few years, with companies onshoring or nearshoring, bringing their operations closer to home, or friendshoring their operations to countries more politically aligned with their own. All in order to adapt to the impacts of the war in Ukraine, rising tensions between the US and China, and changing geopolitical dynamics around the globe. The shift in the tangible movement of goods is hastening a deglobalization process that has been occurring alongside the rise of authoritarianism and protectionist policies, and raises questions about the future of the systems of global trade that have been built up over recent decades. I'll speak to Bruce Jones, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, to understand why the Red Sea attacks have been significant for global trade and what they tell us about the future of asymmetrical and naval warfare. Before speaking to Elizabeth Brawer, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, who explain how other conflicts and geopolitical tensions are reshaping global trade and may decrease the interdependency that has fostered peace and security through the 90s and 2000s. I'm joined by Bruce Jones to help us better understand what's happening on the high seas. Thanks for joining me, Bruce.
Thanks for having me.
First off, I want to start with the basics. I saw your recent social media post where you seemed really overawed by a visit to a domestic US container port. Can you just give us a quick note about why we should even care about this stuff? How integral is shipping to our daily lives? What's the scale of the network of people, places, and things that go into making that happen?
I'm going to start with a small example and zoom outwards. Lots of Americans have Florida orange juice for breakfast. But here's the weird thing. Florida orange juice doesn't come from Florida. The oranges are grown in Brazil and in Central America, and they're turned into pulp, and they're shipped up in a special ship that's been converted from an oil carrier to be an orange juice tanker. And then it comes into the port of Tampa, offloaded by special terminal vehicles onto trucks, which then carry it to a manufacturing plant in Central Florida, where a little bit of Florida orange juice is mixed in so that they can use the term Florida orange juice. It's just a small example. Almost everything that we eat, use, consume in any way in this country has some part of it or all of it that comes to us by sea. 90% of world trade flows by sea. 70% of the world's supply of oil and gas moves by sea. Everything that we use data for, our cell phones, our banking networks, all rely on undersea cables. 95% of the world's data moves by sea on undersea cables. So literally our whole economy and our whole society is dependent on the flow of goods into our ports by sea. We don't see it. We're sort of sea blind as a nation. We've moved our ports out of downtown in most cities, and so they're kind of obscure to us. But our food stocks, everything we manufacture, our iPhones, our breakfast cereals, everything around us comes to us in part by sea.
So it's across everything. I think that's super helpful framing. I want to zoom across now to the Red Sea, to Yemen, to the Houthi attacks over there. What's the impact on supply chains and shipping routes been from those attacks, including the impact for consumers?
So 2 points here. First, the obvious point would be to say, if you disrupt the flow of shipping, you're going to have these huge knock-on effects on supply chains, right? And we saw that during COVID, when there were kind of restrictions on shipping because of the kind of quarantine rules for sailors, these huge backups in the port of LA Long Beach that had immediate effects on inflation. We saw it a couple of years ago when a huge ship, the Ever Given, ran aground in the Suez Canal and everything was backed up and caused inflation. So when the Houthis started attacking shipping in the Red Sea, everybody, myself included, thought we were going to see these huge disruptions to supply chains. It turns out that we've escaped that in this one scenario for a funny reason. And the reason is during COVID, shipping companies made giant profits. Now, that sounds strange, given all the interruptions, and we can go into why, but they made giant profits. And what they did with those profits in the immediate aftermath of COVID is they bought up tons of spare shipping. And so when the Red Sea got attacked by the Houthis, the shipping companies were able to use those big surpluses in shipping that they happened to have. So in fact, we haven't seen much disruption, but still, shipping has not been able to resume flowing through the Red Sea, even though we've had a U.S. and U.K. naval response there. Shipping's having to flow around the Cape of Good Hope. It's much, much longer. It's much slower. But because of this unique post-COVID moment, there's been this kind of extra capacity that was being brought to bear. And so we've escaped the supply chains restrictions that we thought we would see. You know, if it happened again tomorrow, if a new set of attacks blocked another route, they wouldn't be able to replicate this. It's just kind of a one-time thing that we've been able to escape the constrictions to the supply chain from the interruptions to the Red Sea traffic.
Right. And the dynamics of the attacks themselves, they've been a stark example of the power of sort of asymmetrical warfare. You don't need a navy to upend a major shipping route. How significant is that development in your view?
Well, there are two aspects to this. First, we should be clear-eyed in saying that although the front face of these attacks are the Houthis, which are a relatively small group, an army in one of the world's poorest countries, the technology here comes from Iran. You know, substantial military player in the Middle East. They're using the Houthis as a kind of partner in this effort. And there are some tensions between the Houthis and the Iranians, but the technology is Iranian. Second is that we've known for a long time that there were land-based anti-ship missiles. It was a technology first developed by the Chinese. We've just never seen them in action before. And we didn't have 100% certainty that they would work. And so here what we're getting is a kind of live test of what's going to be the most important technology we have to deal with if we end up fighting a naval war with the Chinese. And so we're kind of getting a dry run of what this technology looks like and what our defense systems for dealing with the technology are like. The lessons don't perfectly apply to China, but nonetheless, it's a pretty interesting test of this phenomenon of land-based missiles that can attack shipping for the first time since, you know, cannon fire was striking Royal Navy dreadnoughts.
Right. And in terms of also testing, this seems to have been a way for the Houthis, you know, and Iran through the Houthis to gain relevance in a way that the Houthis have not managed to do even, you know, in a years-long war in Yemen. You know, the answer for them has been upending global commerce, and it has drawn out a reaction. And we've seen, you know, with strategic hostage taking, for an example, sort of a trend develop around that. And I wonder if the Red Sea attacks have exposed sort of policy priorities and whether this could be a point of leverage that we might see exploited in the future. So what do you have a take on that?
Well, I think that what we're dealing with, and it's not only in the Red Sea, it's in the Black Sea, it's in the Baltic Sea, and, you know, hopefully it won't eventually be in the Western Philippine Sea, but it might be. We're dealing with the phenomenon that globalization moves by sea, but we have spent the last 40 years doing two things simultaneously. We have hugely expanded the scope of globalization through sea-based trade, and we've shrunk our navies. We thought we were in a world where, you know, great power conflict wasn't a big factor. The United States had the only blue water navy that mattered. We didn't really keep it up. The British all but disbanded things like their submarine fleet. European navies have been shrinking. So simultaneously, we hugely increased our dependence on the seas, and we substantially shrunk our capacity to protect the seas. And so there's an enormous vulnerability. The most acute vulnerability is actually the undersea cables, on which we're totally reliant and which are totally vulnerable, but also surface shipping is vulnerable. And so what we're seeing is that the Houthis are attacking it. The Russians have been threatening this stuff in the Black Sea and in the Baltic Sea. And it's a core vulnerability that we're going to have to grapple with in the years to come.
Shipping is an important pillar of a broad globalized trading system. To better understand how the Red Sea attacks are impacting global trade, I'm now joined by Elizabeth Brau, a senior fellow at the Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security at the Atlantic Council and author of Goodbye Globalization, The Return of a Divided World. Thanks for joining me, Elizabeth.
It's a pleasure.
Before we get onto issues around globalization and supply chains, I want to look quickly at a couple of threats that you've written about recently. So one of the impacts we've seen as a result of the war in Ukraine and in these increasing geopolitical crisis and conflict is the expansion of a dark fleet of ships. So flagging and ownership of ships is an issue that's seen renewed attention during the Red Sea crisis. However, the shadow fleet or dark fleet is quite a different thing. Can you tell us a little bit about what it is, why we've seen a growth in these dark fleets, and what the scale of that growth has been?
Yes, there's been an extraordinary development. So the shadow fleet isn't new. It has essentially been a collection of merchant vessels that have been transporting cargo to and from Venezuela, Iran, and North Korea for a number of years because these countries are under sanctions, which means that shipping companies and especially maritime insurers don't want to do business with them. Insurers are very concerned about being exposed to sanctions. So that's how the dark fleets became a thing. But the sort of quantum leap it has made in the past couple of years is that Russia has joined this group of essentially outcast nations. And as we all know, Russia is quite a bit bigger, both in terms of population and its economy. So this is the first time that a major economy has essentially been shut out of the globalized economy. But Russia wasn't going to just accept being shut out of the globalized economy. It wants to keep trading with other countries. And that's why the shadow fleet is so important. Of course, the nature of the shadow fleet is that the vessels are very obscure. They were very hard to track, very hard to identify. So nobody's really sure how many vessels there are. But good estimates put the number around 1,400. Oh, that was a few months ago, and it's likely to have grown since then. And 1,400 vessels that don't officially exist, that essentially form a parallel world of shipping, that is quite significant and also quite risky for the official world of shipping.
Right. And of course, they also help to facilitate trade with those countries that are under sanctions. So I guess it's a form of facilitating impunity of some kind outside of the more formal global trading system. And I want to now sort of turn to the recent book you've written on the end of globalization and a return to a divided world. The crisis in the Red Sea and the impact on global shipping routes is obviously the latest in a series of shocks that precipitated a fairly rapid reshaping of the attitude to and practice of global supply and trade. This has seen companies doing what is known as onshoring or nearshoring, where they're bringing their operations close to home or divesting from states with geopolitical concerns or competition. So the US-China tensions are part of that, COVID, Ukraine war, and then, of course, the Red Sea. Can you expand a little on why this is happening and what these sort of major shifts in production and supply chains look like in practice? Like, what are companies actually doing as a result of this?
Yes, I think that the first thing to bear in mind is that the globalization is struggling in the sense that so many different groups of people have lost faith in it. Voters at home in the West, they were the first to essentially say, well, we don't like this sort of far away steering of our lives by politicians and business leaders who meet in Davos. We don't like that. Then after the financial crisis, China started saying, well, what is this US-led capitalism that spreads financial disaster around the world? It's not working for us. Then we saw Western companies that had been happy to do business in China, they started getting concerned about China's systemic undermining of the what was supposed to be a level playing field. And it sort of worked in the 90s when Western companies were far ahead. But now China has produced so many companies that are neck-to-neck competitors to Western companies that then the fact that China really wasn't playing by the rules became a thing. And then we had the reemergence of geopolitics in Russia and also in China, because China has demonstrated now for a number of years that it wants to not just be a global trading power, it wants to dictate to other countries what they should do. And in fact, it may want to take other countries or their territory. So we have so many different factors coming together, collectively causing this loss of faith in globalization. And for companies, when talking heads and academics and politicians say, well, you know, we should decouple, that doesn't mean anything. They will reduce operations in Russia and China if they feel it doesn't make commercial sense to have that heavy exposure to Russia and China anymore. And so what are they doing? Well, if they are operating in Russia, they are trying to leave completely. And a few took the step right after the invasion of Ukraine to say, well, this is one step too far. Russia has changed beyond recognition. It's not working for us anymore. We are leaving. They lost lots of money because they had to sell their operations for a pittance to a local buyer. But nevertheless, they got out of the country. Then when it comes to China, it's a matter of really reducing operations there. And so we'll see companies, Western manufacturers, continue to manufacture in China for the Chinese market, because how can you give up the Chinese market? But they are trying to move operations elsewhere. Where is that elsewhere? That is the question that they have to figure out. It's not going to be just India. India will be important. It's also not going to be just Vietnam, just the Philippines, just Mexico. It's going to have to be a combination of countries. Very difficult if you compare that to China, where it was just one country, one uniform system, incredible transportation, incredible logistics. And now they're having to set themselves, some duplicate themselves in markets that are not prepared for it. But of course, this is an amazing opportunity for these countries that are in a good position to benefit from the struggles of this round of globalization.
Right. And so obviously, this is a result of some shifts in geopolitics and so on, but it may also then impact geopolitics in itself as a process. What are some of the combined impacts you're seeing of these shifts in this global economic activity? And what do you expect to see as this continues?
So what we are already seeing is the emergence of two informal blocs, a new divided world where Western countries are increasing trade with countries that are somewhat friendly. You don't have to be exactly like us, because not many countries are exactly like us, but at least not hostile. So that is what is emerging. And China is doing the same. China and Russia are doing the same, trying to get as many countries as possible on their team. And we'll see the same thing in business, and especially in manufacturing, that the race will be on for who gets them on their team, just like it was during the Cold War, really, when some of your listeners may remember, when a country like Angola was important because it was a country that could go either way when both sides wanted it. And that's what we'll see again. The race is on for many countries, most especially India. And it's a country in which Western businesses would like to expand their operations. And it is also an incredible chance for India, which was always a runner-up to China, was always seen as chaotic and so not as good a place to invest in as China. Now India is getting a second chance, but of course, for Western companies to want to invest there, India has to be friendly with the West, at least a lot of the time, even if not all of the time.
Right. And we've seen that, you know, the process of globalization had some positive impacts in terms of global cooperation and a knock-on effect there on peace and security, and that decoupling may have the opposite impact. And we saw, I think, in the lead up to the World War II, you know, a shift away from multilateral trade as well. And some are sort of saying that the changing nature of globalization now bears a resemblance to that time. Can you talk a little more about what the security impact of these major shifts and change might have at this time?
One of the reasons so many politicians liked globalization, so many Western politicians, but others as well, was that not only was it good for the each country's national economy, you know, the more you trade, the more you can specialize and the more prosperity increases financially, economically, globalization is good for everyone. But there was also this idea that the more you trade, the friendlier you become. That's not a new idea. It has been around for a long time. And before World War One, even, that was something that so many people believed in. And then that incredible level of commerce they had amongst many countries before World War One just was no protection whatsoever when it did arrive. But that mindset that if goods cross borders, soldiers won't, is what made people believe in globalization so strongly. But I think what I've discovered is in practice, it doesn't work like that. And the analogy I see is when you fall in love with somebody, everything looks good in the beginning and you're willing to disregard flaws because everything else is so good. And then the more time you spend together, and then if you get married, if it's not a good match, you do start paying attention to those flaws and they become such an irritant that they may cause you in the end to say, well, it's not working, we'll have to split up. And that's what happened with globalization. We overlooked or didn't want to see how different China and also Russia were from us in the West. And we were willing to put up with many things that logically we shouldn't have put up with. And they might say the same thing from that perspective. They put up with things they shouldn't have put up with. But anyway, here we are, like a divorcing couple, so upset about the other side's many annoying habits that we're saying it's not working. That's, I think, a lesson for the next round of globalization whenever it comes.
But do you see this kind of shift into blocks, if you will, you know, more into trading blocks that we're seeing, and then having an impact on peace and security in the short term before we go back through these various cycles of globalization down the track?
What we're seeing at the moment is just a staggering array of rule breaking. So the shadow fleet is one of those examples. The fact that a leading country, one with a seat on the UN Security Council, can just blatantly run its economy on the basis of maritime rule breaking. And if we look in the Red Sea, there is rule breaking going on by the Houthis, and it's not clear what anybody can do about it. And you would think that if China and Russia were upstanding members of the rules-based international community, they would tell the Houthis, we stand on the side of the law-abiding countries of the world, stop these attacks. And by the way, China, the Chinese Navy has the world's largest fleet. Russia and China have done no such thing. They have not intervened in any way. And instead, they appear to have negotiated a deal with the Houthis through which Chinese and Russian vessels are not targeted by the Houthis. So it's just one rule violation after the other. And indeed, China itself has broken many maritime rules by building artificial islands in the South China Sea, by harassing Philippine vessels and so forth. And Russia has, of course, violated the most important principle of all. It's not just globalization that's in trouble. It's this whole network of global rules that we set up after the end of World War II and again after the end of the Cold War. And if you don't have a critical mass of people, of nations, protecting and obeying those rules, then the whole system is in trouble. But good news is that actually this round of globalization wasn't perfect and it needed to be reformed. This is the opportunity to build a better version of globalization.
Reimagining global trade is going to take some time, but a deglobalizing world, increasing naval conflict, and shifting shipping routes will have shorter-term impacts on peace and security. I asked Bruce about what's in store. Policing the world's trade routes has primarily been a U.S. pastime. You know, the U.S. spends a not insignificant portion of its GDP policing those shipping routes. How does Operation Prosperity Guardian change or develop from this sort of very US-led approach? And how do you see the whole sort of approach to policing shipping routes developing in an age of geopolitical competition?
Well, it's very instructive to compare the international response to Somali piracy in the Gulf of Aden, you know, a decade and a half ago to the Red Sea. That was the last time we saw a major upsurge in attacks on shipping. And of course, historically, piracy has been the main thing we've thought about when we've thought about attacks on shipping. Just as sort of shipping was really taking off as the kind of new form of globalization, the Somalis saw the opportunity and started attacking it. And what we saw in response was a huge European response, a NATO response, and we saw China, India, Russia, and Pakistan and several other countries joining into the fight. All of it coordinated by NATO. Imagine, NATO was coordinating Russian and Chinese ships. Fast forward to the present day, and I have to say the West's response has been pretty chaotic. The US and the UK doing one thing, nominally organized through a coalition that barely exists, that they have to disown when they act, and then the Europeans showing up, you know, several weeks later, but only doing some of the things, and the Indians playing a little bit of a role, but not much, and Japanese occasionally weighing in, and totally disorganized, not very effective, and the Chinese and the Russians very explicitly staying out of it, even though China is even more dependent on global shipping than we are. And so you see in the comparison the kind of way in which geopolitical tension has eroded our capacity to collaborate on protecting shipping or virtually anything else. But we're going to have to grapple with this issue because it ain't the last time we're going to see this problem.
And who is grappling with it? How do you see that sort of line of thinking in action?
Honestly, no one. It's really not well understood. Funny thing, the Navy has this line as part of their sales pitch that part of what they do is protect freedom of navigation. And it is true that if an American flagship comes under attack from pirates or et cetera, the United States sees a responsibility to respond. And in the Red Sea, it's gone beyond that. It's protecting not just American flag shipping, but global shipping. But it is not the case that the Navy is organized or sees protection of global trade flows as central to its mandate. But actually protecting global shipping per se is not really what the U.S. Navy thinks it's doing. And it's certainly not organized to do it on a global scale. And we don't have anything like the coordinating mechanisms to allow us to drive serious collaboration, even if Europeans would get back into the business of having serious navies.
What other second order impacts, you know, are you looking out for? Because there is this narrative that it's just about people getting their Shein orders on time or their new Samsung television or, you know, the impact on the cost of living. But two major losers in the Red Sea have been Sudan, who, you know, aid ships are not able to dock there to get the supplies they so desperately need. And Egypt, who've had to receive a major bailout due to the tanking currency, which, although it wasn't all caused by the dip in traffic in the Suez Canal. I mean, that's certainly been part of it. Where's vulnerable right now?
Well, it's a good question. the Russian threat here has been perhaps the thing that has caused most sort of a wake-up moment, at least in the United States and in NATO. And that's not a threat to surface shipping. It's Russian submarines, and especially special-purpose submarines, sniffing around undersea cables off the coast of the United Kingdom and the Baltic Sea, etc. Now, there are two reasons you might want to have a submarine sniffing around undersea cables. One is for espionage. We do that, the Russians do that, and anybody who has serious subs does that. But the other thing you can do is sabotage. You can sever cables. And the disruption that would be caused if we saw a severing of a major set of cables connecting New York to London, for example, would be simply massive. We've already seen a little bit of this in the Red Sea. There were four cables that were damaged. We don't exactly know what caused the damage. My suspicion is it was essentially one of the missiles that was shot at a ship and that missed and then sort of exploded, you know, and caused damage on the seabed rather than a deliberate attack. I simply don't see any evidence that the Iranians have the kind of sophisticated submarine capability to do serious damage. But Russia has them, and they have them in spades. And so that's the thing that's really caused people to sit up and say, oh, damn, this could be a major problem. I haven't yet seen the kind of serious mapping of the second order effects of the cost of shipping. One big exception. When we saw the fighting in the Black Sea, remember at this early point in the Ukraine war, that fight was immediately disrupting the flow of trade out of the Black Sea. And that turns out to be about 40% of the world's supply of food and fertilizer. So there were potentially huge knock-on effects. We saw big price spikes in a lot of the developing world. But, you know, we were risking much more than that. There was a serious risk of famine for tens of millions of people if we couldn't get those grain and fertilizer supplies out. In the end, there was a diplomatic solution to that. But it was a kind of a wake-up call to the second-order effects that you're describing. I haven't seen the work done yet to map that out on a global scale to see where we could be facing that next.
Are there any other choke points with this sort of proliferation of conflict and geopolitical crisis that you're looking ahead to where you think, you know, there is danger on the high seas afoot?
Well, you know, there are three that keep me up at night. The dangers are different and the consequences are different. So there's the Strait of Hormuz. 60% of the world's supply of oil and gas flows out of the Strait of Hormuz. If there were a serious interruption to those flows, we'd be in deep trouble economically. I mean, the global economy would be in major, major trouble. What makes me feel a little less alarmed by that is if you look at the geopolitics of this, the first people that would feel that consequence are the Chinese. And so if the threat to shipping out of the Strait of Hormuz is the Iranians attacking Western shipping, well, Western shipping is flowing oil to China. And given the relationship between the Chinese and the Iranians, I think there are some restraints about the kind of disruption of the Hormuz. The second big one is the Strait of Malacca, and we've seen it interrupted by piracy before. That immediately met with a huge international response, similar to the one I described in the Gulf of Aden. To this day, the Americans, the Chinese, the Indians, the Russians, everybody works together to counter piracy through the Strait of Malacca. But if we saw the kind of thing we're seeing in the Red Sea there, that could be a different kind of problem. And then the big kahuna here is the South China Sea. 50% of the world's trade flows through the South China Sea. And if the United States and China get into a naval fight in those waters, the consequences in terms of the disruption of global trade would be simply enormous. Really devastating to the world economy. And of course, the United States is aware of that, and China is aware of that, and you would think that that would be a major deterrent to conflict in those waters, but it may well not be.
And that's where you'd start to see huge implications for your everyday consumer, I imagine.
I mean, massive, massive implications. Bloomberg estimates the cost of a war with Taiwan at $10 trillion, but I think that actually underestimates the kind of knock-on effects. It's hard to measure these things sometimes. Let me just give you another example back to the U.S. economy. The United States still makes some of its own cars, but we don't make any windshields. We import 100% of the windshields on cars that are sold in the United States. Now, a windshield is maybe 2% of the value of a car, but try selling a car without a windshield. So if you can't import windshields because your sea-based trade is interrupted, the fact that you can manufacture the other 98% of the car doesn't really help you. And you can just replicate that through farm machinery, through computers, through televisions, through any product you want. There are going to be critical parts that are coming to us by sea. And if the sea lanes are badly interrupted or shipping stops flowing because of a crisis in the Western Pacific, just the entire global economy and the entire U.S. economy will be crippled.
Someone once said of globalization that it's not a monolithic force, but an evolving set of consequences, some good, some bad, and some unintended. Is the same going to be said of its unraveling? Thanks for listening. I'm Emma Beals, and this is Not a Drill. See you next time.